Good evening and welcome to Screen Tone Club, the only manga podcast that can handle two series of an overwhelming amount of snow in a single episode. We have trudged through the slush to bring you tidings of manga on this episode 164. My name is Elliot Page, freshly spurned by my cat who was not happy with the idea of sharing the attention with my lovely podcasting public, and joined by my lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. I'm very disappointed that we're not going to have like a bonus guest to talk about the topics on this episode, but clearly more important things to be done.
Yeah, more important things like sitting in the bath. What are you doing in there? Anyway, whatever. I can't just keep staring at my cat while we're supposed to talk about manga. Manga. In fact, I don't think there's any cats in either of these series. So, oh well, minus points right away. Quick shout out to our shout out tier member, Mr. Rob Jessup. So thank you ever so much for supporting us. Let's just get right down to it, shall we? I'm kind of keen to get these talked about, frankly, if that sounds a bit strange. Do you mind if I take first stab with my pick?
Let's go for it.
So I'm going to do a bit of preamble about how this series came to be, because I had to get it straight in my head. And I feel like this is a franchise that's kind of gone by the by for reasons that maybe we'll get into, frankly. So my pick was Volume 1 of Kaina of the Great Snow Sea. The author is Sutomo Nihei, and the artist is Itoe Takemoto, which I'm going to sound a bit mean here, but when I saw that, I assumed Nihei would be drawing and someone else would be writing. That would be my desire, but no, apparently not. This is a franchise that came about as being a direct or anime original project with Polygon Pictures for their anniversary. I forget which number the anniversary is, so I'm not going to guess and get it wrong. But they got together with Nihei and said, hey, we've adapted some of your stuff. Do you want to do a thing? And they did. So chronologically, the manga comes out first, although it itself is an adaptation of what would become the manga material, the anime material, sorry. The manga released in 2022. The anime came out on Crunchyroll in 2023. And then there was a subsequent sequel / finishing movie. And so, yeah, that's the order it goes in, basically. This is four volumes long. It's published by Kodansha, who apparently was previously published by Crunchyroll, but I can't find too much concrete information on that, even though Crunchyroll are currently like relaunching a new manga app, which I have not looked at, frankly, because I spent long enough looking at their old one, quite between me and you. It was originally published in Japan in Shonen Sirius, the same publication which publishes Tower Dungeon at the moment. It's currently complete. It's all of four volumes long. You can get it physically or digitally in volume form. It is notably not in Kodansha's K-Manga service, which is where I first went to try and find it. And so, yeah, Kaina of the Great Snow Sea lets you assume from the title. The main character is Kaina, who is a generic black-haired late teen, early 20s Nihei protagonist. He lives with the local like olden committee in a little village. He lives on a canopy, which is this giant like membranous layer above the earth, and they can see through it because it's translucent. It's held up by a bunch of fleshy sort of like vertical growths, like pillars. And they can see that underneath is basically a gigantic sea of snow, which is where the title comes from. And, you know, sometimes there's a rip or a tear in the membrane, which can be dangerous to fall into because God knows how far you'll fall, quite honestly. Anyway, Kaina goes out hunting, you know, and you get a little bit of daily life with Kaina and his friends. And, you know, all of them complain saying, oh, man, like, we're all old. The only young person here is Kaina. Wouldn't that be dangerous? We want to see Kaina get hitched. And then basically a bunch of oldens eat dinner and ship their one young charge or friend. Kaina's also learning English by reading a bunch of bizarre discarded signs from the old world. And of course, the like village kook is the one who collects and reads these signs. And into his life flies Princess Ririha, who is from the Great Snow Sea. She and a bunch of jobbers, unfortunately, on a bunch of snow dolphin things? I don't know. They're not very distinct, frankly. But they catch a floater, not a turd you can't flush, but in this case, a giant spore-like thing, you know, Nihei in his lovely, gross, spore-like sort of concepts of stuff. So they catch a floater, and it floats up dutifully after everyone who is not Ririha gets deaded. And the two meet. So Kaina finds Ririha as she's floating up on her little, hot air balloon, which she has made. And basically the two of them are now together, and both of them are thinking about or talking about the sage, like a smart, wise person who knows about how all this came to be, why there's a giant membranous canopy above stuff, and why there's a big snow sea underneath. And it becomes apparent that basically, like, both above and below ground are in deep crap, because there's a acute lack of drinking water, and it's getting less and less, and frankly demographic collapse, given that, like, Kaina is the only person we've met above the canopy who is of, like, not 70 plus. And so there's kind of those two threats. In fact, it's even mentioned at one point, the, like, root water issue. And so, yeah, that's the setup. And that's kind of where this first volume has gotten to, is the kind of agreement between Kaina and Ririha to, yeah, maybe you should do something about this. If we don't, someone has to. But then again, everyone else here is old as hell. So, and also, I should have mentioned, the reason why Ririha is on this journey anyway is because there's an evil empire, which is hunting her down. And she says, oh, we better get back because, negotiation period's running out. And it's like, lass, they just slaughtered your entire honor guard. I think negotiations have concluded and not in your favor. So maybe get a clue there. I kind of have a whole, like, thought about this franchise. I mean, hell, like, frankly, my first time watching it was when I watched a sequel movie when I went out to Japan in 2023. So I've come to this series in the exact wrong order, which you possibly could. I got to admit, like, just as my sort of start for 10, I found this series to be almost, frankly, intolerably dull, for reasons I'll get to. But I should hand over to you, Andy, and say, what do you think of Kaina and the Great Snow Sea?
Yeah, I mean, it just feels kind of bland to me. Yeah. Like, that was the sort of the overriding word that just kept popping up in my head when whenever I thought about it. And yeah, it's kind of weird because, you know, talking about its history, like, I remember this being sort of pushed around as quite a big deal at the time in terms of, like, yeah, you know, like, it was Polygon's 40th anniversary, for reference. I remember, I remember it being quite a big thing of, like, you know, obviously they were sort of somewhat on the Nihei train, and it's just like, oh, you know, here's an entirely new work, you know, kind of, it's going to be a big deal, it's going to be on Netflix, and then it just sort of vanished into the ether, which is, you know, partly like, while it was on Netflix, that kind of tends to happen.
Wasn't it on Crunchyroll, instead of Netflix?
No, I'm pretty sure it's part of the Polygon deal with Netflix, where they Netflix originaled everything.
Oh, I've been hornswoggled by Wikipedia. My apologies.
I mean, I could be wrong. I just feel like I remember that being part of the firmament of stuff that was on Netflix. But either way, it definitely just kind of fell by the wayside, and kind of, yeah, coming back and reading this, I can just kind of see why. Because, like, there's nothing sort of wrong, and, like, there's potentially, like, a lot of interesting sort of angles to, like, the overall setup, but, like, both of the main characters are just kind of not particularly interesting at this juncture. Like, you know, like you say, you've got a very much your sort of generic protagonist in Kaina, and then Ririha seems like she's going to be kind of awesome for a few pages, and then she just kind of, like, yeah, she gets rescued once and then immediately gets into trouble and gets rescued again, like, pretty much as soon as she's, like, let out of the house. And it's like, oh, I don't know, that's kind of disappointing.
Yeah, when she shows up, I was like, oh, this is, someone's been re-watching Ghibli films again. Maybe this is going to be, like, a cool Nihei Nausicaa. That's a phrase I never thought I'd say out loud. And no. Oh, thank you. Yes, love a good portmanteau. But yeah, no, she does nothing. Like, she even, like, has, like, what appears to be possibly a special knife, because, like, for many reasons, there's just not a lot in here to really get your teeth into. And yeah, she kind of does nothing, and it's very annoying as a result.
Yeah, and I think this also kind of goes back to, like, what you were saying about the artwork not being Nihei. Like, honestly, one of the most kind of, like, upsetting things almost about this is you get to the end of this first volume, and you get all the original Nihei character designs and, like, you know, like, concept art, and, like, this just looks so much more awesome. Like, yeah, I'm not even a huge booster always for like Nihei's art. Like, I can kind of, it's kind of hit or miss for me, but like, there's just, I mean, in a way, like, the artwork in this volume sort of makes sense because of like all of the snow and the fact that this is kind of a world where there's just not much left, but it just makes it a really very deeply uninteresting thing to actually look at and consume, because it's very sparse, it's very white, it's very kind of like washed out almost. And it does, it kind of works in that it does feel like the end of a world where, like, you know, the final sort of generation is probably dying out. But there are so many more interesting ways I feel like you can show that and at least put a bit of life into it somewhere. Well, and this just doesn't feel like that.
Sorry. Well, it comes off as being like crushingly sterile. There was a moment in the middle which kind of crystallized why I found the series so frustrating visually, because there's nothing there. And so basically there's a point where Kaina has pulled Ririha unconscious out of the like runaway hot air balloon she's made. And it's just, it's the start of chapter three, the very first page of chapter three, where the two of them are stood on the membrane, but it's just a pure white background. And there's like a piece of offshoot vein or whatever in the background, but they're floating in midair because they're not shown to be standing on anything. They leave no impression, both, you know, haha, that could be said about the series as a whole. But like where they're standing, it's not like the membrane has got any give to it, or there's any shading or any like pressure, you know, because at one point Kaina says, oh, the membrane's gone a bit slack here. Oh no, there's a giant hole. Oh, and there's a lady who's flying by. But you don't see that at all in the artwork because the camera's on Kaina's upper body. But then when the camera is facing down towards him and Ririha on the membrane, again completely white, there's nothing there. They are floating in midair. There's no interaction. I mean, in fact, this is quite something that drove me bananas about most of the series, is there's no interaction between different objects. It's like every single actor, it's like a weirdly sort of like handled video game collision engine where nothing ever touches anything else. Like, things are laid on top of each other, but there's no interaction, there's no touching, there's no interface. It's wild. I mean, more than once there's a case, I mean, like you mentioned, that Ririha gets herself back in trouble again, and like the artwork is so loosey-goosey and hard to follow almost that you just don't know what's happening. It's like, I guess she's falling down, I don't quite know what's happening. More, in fact, like Kaina has this like harpoon gun thingy, but both times when it has like a thunk sound effect and it's hit home, you can't see where it's hit. I had to stare at these panels to figure out what was going on with the action, and it's maddening because it gives you zero tension. Like, there's already no tension with the characters, and then there's no tension with the action, and it's really like the series, the artwork in particular, just doesn't have a way to like draw the eye across the page to where you should be looking. Again, especially with the what few combat scenes happen, which is mostly kind of shoots a thing and it's all fine. And yeah, it's just, it looks so sterile and lifeless and motion free. It's almost like seeing a bunch of stills. It brought to mind actually something which I'm glad I don't think they make these anymore, and it's probably a good reason. Do you remember anime manga during the like highs of the early noughts, when like, you know, manga let you print money, and especially if you're the one who licensed Fullmetal Alchemist, where I remember there being one for Inuyasha in particular, where it would take stills from the anime and then arrange them like it was a comic, or, you know, like a manga. And that had the same problem of like, yeah, you're just taking stills from a moving image and slapping them together into a rather strange book. I never understood what made that interesting. Like, I'd pick it up and look for it and go, what the hell? Why would you buy this?
Yeah. Well, it's also kind of weird because, like, as somebody who came from a generation where, like, all the cartoons got sticker albums, like, that was kind of the same thing. But the point was, you were collecting the stickers, and that's what made it interesting. Like, you take the collection part out of that and you just have the stills, and yeah, it's really not, there's not much to it at all.
Yeah, for sure, because as I say, you're stripping the motion out of a motion-based thing. And so yeah, like, just this entire series, both in artwork and character and event, is entirely sterile feeling, which is all again like, to echo what you said earlier, because I kind of blasted past it, but yeah, getting to the end and seeing Nihei's like preparatory work, I'm like, man, like, I don't think Nihei could have, quote, fixed this or made it good. Like, I don't think there's enough there, but it was a case of like, oh, there's the seed of what became, and you can see all the attention and the work in the characters. I'm like, yeah, this is, you know, this is a Nihei work, and this is the kind of stuff that I like. So,
and sometimes at least having something visually interesting can sort of elevate everything else. Again, I feel like the whole harpoon gun thing is a really good example, because harpoons are awesome. Like, harpoons are kind of one of the coolest things that you can see in anything, because, you know, you've got, it's always a big old hefty kind of, you know, tool. It's got the big old kind of, like, you know, actual spike that sticks into things. It's got, you know, the rope that follows after it, or whatever it is that, you know, you can have, like, you know, swinging and flashing around as you fire it. Like, you know, those things get used in, like, movies and TV shows and anime and manga a lot, because there's cool, and there's a lot of cool effects that just make them look exciting.
Yeah.
And just to have something like that, and somehow, like, even that just, you know, it just doesn't do anything, like, of any kind of interest, sort of almost is the perfect example of what this series is just seemingly incapable of doing.
Yeah, there's no reaction or action to any of it, like, you know, the times that kind of does use the harpoon gun. And like I say, like, at least twice, like, the harpoon gets lost when it's embedded in something. That's not what should happen. Like, harpoons are supposed to be cool. And you, I mean, like, in some more than what, in, I think, especially in the first use, it gets, you know, the actual harpoon itself gets lost amongst the, like, speed lines.
Mm.
And it's like, this sucks. Like, this, it, you know, the whole thing as a result, I mean, both the writing and the art feels very first draft, frankly.
Mm.
Like, yeah. they didn't put the sauce in, as it were. You know, it's just, oh, it's a bowl of plain pasta. Is there any sauce? No.
Yeah, which is, I mean, and it's also weird in some ways, because, you know, the way it sets up Kiner has just been like, okay, well, you're the last kind of young man here. It's like, you know, I mean, much as I'm not always a fan of, like, you know, the sort of the anime and manga cliche of, like, oh my god, a real girl. Like, but even his reaction to kind of, like, meeting Rohe is very kind of underwhelming for somebody who's just been kind of stuck with sort of, you know, all these old people, and, you know, having impressed upon him over and over again of just like, ah, you know, like, you know, this, we're all going to die out unless something happens here. And, like, it just feels very just kind of, you know, again, bland and very meek in what should be this seismic moment of, like, oh my god, like, you know, who the hell are you? But it just feels very kind of, you know, performative and perfunctory when it actually comes to it.
Yeah, it almost feels like the series itself is not bothering to, like, inject anything, because it's just like, yeah, you know that they're going to move on, and, you know, you can kind of get, like, it feels like the series itself is telling you, like, yeah, we're just kind of spinning our wheels here until we get to the next bit. And it's like, that's not fair or fun. And, you know, I honestly, the single most engaging character beat that happens in this is when, like, the WI turn up to measure Riraha and for a snowsuit, which one of the things it doesn't do is actually provide, again, any tension, where, like, you know, at one point Riraha wakes up floating up in the balloon and then faints again. And I presume it has to be because, like, the air is thin up there on top of the canopy, and that's why Kaina has, like, the mask. But at no point does it mention any of that, or fill it in, or provide any exposition. And hell, there's a part that is drove me mad where Riraha has woken up, she's had breakfast, you know, they've all introduced and made sure they're all non-threatening. And then the Aldens say, oh, you know, Kaina, show her around the place. And then there's, like, half a page of it, and that's it. Like, there's two cutaway panels of Riraha being a bit grossed out by the weird, like, survivalist life they're living, and then, like, the rest of the page is them walking on a wooden plank stairwell in nothing. There's nothing there. It's empty. They're in a void, and it's so maddening, because it's like, what the hell are you doing? Like, you could have used, like, I'm not expecting you to write an entire Wikipedia article or anything, but, like, you could have used this opportunity to introduce us, the reader, to the world as it is, via Riraha and Kaina. But you didn't. You skipped past it. And it's so maddening, because it's like, this is, like, and because it's not just not bothering to tell you that, but it's also letting you know that none of this matters. Like, none of this matters. And he's like, this sucks. Like, again, nothing to get invested in, nothing to care about.
Yeah, which is another part of it that is super weird for, like, Nihei's stuff. Because if there's one thing that is just, like, the absolute sort of catnip, and, like, you know, the one thing that I kind of glom onto most with something like A Knights of Cydonia or Blam or whatever is just, like, the world. And it's usually very good, both visually and in terms of just setup of depicting that world, opening it up to you, showing you new locations as you go, and being, and, you know, kind of explaining how this world works and why it works the way that it does. Like, I mean, again, I feel like Blam and Cydonia are both really good examples of, like, you know, there are these fully formed worlds that sort of open up to you from, you know, a very simple start, and the more you get to see of it, the more kind of compelling it gets. Whereas this, again, yeah, it just doesn't feel like it has any sort of impact. And again, given that the world and the world state is sort of the important thing, the overriding concern of everybody in this series, it also feels very dashed off of just like, ah, yeah, this is where we're at.
Yeah, it's like absolute, like, you know, demographic collapse, you know, world collapse. Like, there's a reason why the evil empire is being an evil empire, is because there's a resource war going on. And hell, even when, like, Rivihat's caravan comes under attack, like, people fall into the snow sea, but there's no real follow-up on what that means. Like, there's like half a panel which is like a cutaway shot, like showing you people floating in the snow sea, but it doesn't tell you anything. Like, is it viscous? Can people float? Do people, like, if you fall in the snow sea, are you doomed forever to die? Like, who knows? It doesn't say anything. Nothing, like, nothing is important. And it's maddening, because even the setting, as you say, what little it does deign to give you just is null. Hell, even, like, again, this is, I feel this is kind of a maturity of art problem. Like, there's a point, so when they're hooking up the, like, basket to the floater initially, there the evil empire ship has fired a catapult at them, but the way the panel's laid out means that the cannonball intersects with the basket and you can't see the difference there, so it just mushes it all together, and it's really hard to find, to see. Like, I had to go back to that page and go, oh, that is a cannonball, or like a net full of stones, and it's like, okay, but this, how was I supposed to see that? And
yeah,
like, also, like, frankly, the series, especially on the first chapter, has a real love of putting these like gray to white gradients over the top of the panels, which then crushes the like available color space down even further, and so everything just kind of comes off as being muddy and indistinct and not detailed in any way, and so visually uninteresting. I really am just going knives out for this poor series, but honestly, it really is kind of a waste, and I just found it super, like, you know, it wasn't actively bad, but it was just boring as sin. So.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think the only kind of positive interaction I had with it is, like, the whole, the ancient signs and, like, you know, the whole discussion around those, because that's actually a pretty, like, it's actually quite a good little bit of world building, one of the few that it does, and also like, it's quite a good kind of humorous thing of just like, again, you've got your typical kind of, like, you know, slightly unhinged guy who is sort of the sage ? Of this whole situation, and he's just like, oh yeah, like, these are signs that have been left by, you know, with important information from the ancients, and it's just like, it's just, the sign is just, you know, like, slippery surface or something, and it's like, yeah, actually this is quite good and entertaining, but that's literally only a few pages of this thing.
Yeah, at the risk of just blasting out like what would be a very minor spoiler for the movie, that is basically the crux of the most important plot point of the movie, is they get to a facility and there are signs there, and then the people there have to try and patch together between them what the hell it says. So that, you know, that's like a key plot point of the ending of the movie, is, hey, I think between a lot of us, we can kind of figure out what the hell this sign says. Of course, me being not very good at reading Japanese was stuck in the showing, because it was a Japanese language showing. So, yeah. Oops. So, yeah, I was just as mystified as the rest of them.
Yeah. I was hoping that, like, the big kind of cliffhanger at the end of the film is that they discover they're actually on the M25 ring road, and it's like, oh, no, what is this little chef?
Wait, what do you mean, Milton Keynes? Oh, God, we're stuck forever.
Yeah, we really are at the end of the world.
Yeah, we're just going round and round and round. Jesus. But yeah, I could go on a bit more, but I think I've kind of covered all the things I wanted to. As I say, just crushingly dull. And also just sad, because there is something there perhaps, but you'd have to dig real hard to find it, and it's just kind of a big fat nothing. I mean, honestly, I'm, you know, if this was intended as an advert for the anime, then oh boy, you've unsold me on that.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I think, you know, we were having already referenced, like, Nausicaa, the, like, that's kind of like the gold standard if you're doing a story like this. Because there's quite a lot of differences, but like it definitely feels like it sort of exists in that kind of space. And it's like, oh boy, are you going up against like a 400-pound gorilla there? And you know, you've just brought like a stuffed chimpanzee toy, and this is not going to end well for you.
Yeah, I mean, Nausicaa. Like, we should probably do a Nausicaa on the podcast at some point, but like Nausicaa is like. This is like, to do a rather dumb comparison, like Kaina is like a very, very, very soft butter knife, and like Nausicaa is like a flint obsidian blade. It cuts You know, Miyazaki was like on something when he was writing that, and he wanted to tell you something through the medium of like hella poisonous gas and oh crap, the world is super angry at us, and check out this giant bug monster, isn't it cute? Also, main characters here, she's like, you know, like sainted almost, like goddess like while being a cute lass with, you know, a Ghibli lass. But yeah, that's a series that won't let you forget about it, that's for sure. But yeah, I do you have anything else to mention about Kaina of the Great Snow Snee?
No, I think that is everything.
Okay, moving on to your pick, Andy. Another rather strange adaptation in its own way.
Yeah, so my pick for this episode is Search and Destroy Volume 1, which is basically kind of a remaking and reimagining of Simon Tezuka's Dororo, which kind of started life as part of a sort of more general anthology of people remaking Tezuka works. I believe that the author of this, like Atsushi Kaneko, wanted to do another Tezuka story, and they were just like, no, that's too obscure, pick something else. and so he went with Dororo. This is published in English by Fantagraphics. Translator for the English edition is Ben Applegate. Originally published in Tezukomi as part of the aforementioned anthology. That was back in 2018. It is completed just 3 volumes in Japanese, 2 volumes out in English thus far. So it's almost done, available from all the usual kind of physical and digital places.
For the digital one, sorry to be a pain, it's only on Kindle. Because Fantagraphics, at the risk of sounding extremely mean and petty, Fantagraphics haven't figured out digital distribution at all. and getting a hold of their stuff is a nightmare, and frankly the fact it's on Kindle itself is already a kind of a mild miracle. So it's also, sorry to jump in more, it's also been serialized on other manga podcasts, Mangasplaining Extra. They have like a Substack where you can subscribe to it and get serialized chapters of the series on there. So they have a few series they have licensed or like pseudo licensed to show in that way. The serialization is currently on like the second chapter of the last volume, so that's where you can also read it if you have that already. I didn't look too much further into it beyond that. So
I think that is actually kind of like where it appeared first in English, and then like Fantagraphics kind of picked it up for sort of like collected releases from there. Which is actually kind of part of, an important part of this, because like this first volume does feature an introduction that is sort of part of that release that is actually kind of quite useful in terms of setting the scene and sort of the tone of this version of Dororo, that kind of I actually found quite informative as a sort of starting point that gets dropped in right at the start.
Informative, but unfortunately also kind of bigged it up to a huge degree just before you start reading it. So at that point, it kind of set itself a bar to clear as soon as I started reading.
That is true. Basically, Search and Destroy is kind of like a sci-fi version of Dororo. So it is effectively your two main characters are Doro, who is this sort of child thief, sort of street urchin, if you like, who is kind of, you know, gabbing around this sort of futuristic city, which is basically the home to humans and robots, effectively. They're known as like creatures, and humans are known as Hugh, which I feel like maybe this doesn't play quite the same in Japanese, because it was kind of really weird how this manga feels like it needs to explain that, and it's like, no, I get it, that's really very obvious.
But not the only thing it also has to take pains to explain. So
like this is kind of always your typical sort of like dystopian future city, in terms of there are a bunch of individuals here who are mostly kind of creatures, who are kind of clearly sort of, you know, the quote unquote elite of the city. And a lot of the ones that we meet initially are, they have human parts to them, because for all of the kind of technology, there is still something to be said for having actual human eyes or actual human tongue that can do human things and kind of, you know, give you a more full-throated view of the world, if you like. And of course, all of these parts, as it turns out, belong to our main character, Hyaku, because the original story of Dororo is that, you know, Hyaku is basically kind of cut up into 48 parts and dispensed to, I think it's demons in the original.
It's demons, yeah.
Yes, whereas here it is these kind of, these various individuals. And of course, Hyaku kind of wants the bits of his body back, of her body back in this version, because Hyaku is actually female in this edition. And so this is really kind of the story of Hyaku going around as sort of a kind of assassin, effectively just going around taking out everybody who has a body part of hers. Usefully, you know, she had like effectively like a DNA tracker to find them and track them down. And kind of Doro just sort of falls in with her because out of a kind of general sort of both fascination and self-preservation of like, you're both useful and interesting, so I'm just going to kind of follow you around and hang out with you.
Yeah, he kind of takes the angle of, man, if I hang around with you, I'll be mostly safe, but also it won't be boring, and yeah, maybe I'll be able to, like, you know, get dinner, etc.
Pretty much. And so yeah, this first volume basically kind of gives you some of the initial sort of quests, if you like, of kind of Hyaku like regaining some of her body parts, but also a big old kind of flashback to sort of her origin story, with the kind of sort of professor that has sort of rebuilt her like after what has happened, but clearly kept from her what her actual kind of origin story is. There's a whole kind of civil war that goes on and ends, and then ultimately kind of things go bad, and Hyaku is sort of left to her own devices, having been told the truth, and then, you know, fast forward back to our kind of present day.
But not before the video cuts out, before the true terrible secret is revealed. Thanks, but, Doctor.
But of course, yeah, it's you know, it's always the classic video game. Like, I'm recording this voice log, and then it cuts out. Just
I feel like this is the one case where like the audio log actually works, because he's recording it in real time as the place gets invaded.
Yes.
So the whole like, oh no, they're coming through the walls, they've got knives, blarg, actually works for once.
Yeah,
Because you see the whole texture of it. It's not just like BioShock where it's, you know, or Itchy Tasty from Resident Evil.
Yeah. So I absolutely with you on that. And so, yeah, like I will say, like, I've not read like the original Dororo manga. I did watch the anime adaptation that came out in, I think it was like 2019 or so. And kind of really enjoyed that. And I've got to admit, I really like this as well. This did a lot for me. Like, I mean, artwork wise, I think it's kind of tremendous. It ticks a lot of boxes for stuff that, I kind of catnip to me. Like the whole kind of future city has a very sort of like, you know, Soviet era, but the future vibe to it that is pretty cool. Like, it has a lot of really good sort of architectural scenes of kind of like showing you that cityscape. Like, as you mentioned, lots of rain and snow. It has that good sort of like, everything is kind of bad here, but, you know, this is where we're at. Right.
It's bad for certain people, but I'll let you carry on, sorry.
And you know, it has a really good kind of visual look to it. All of the kind of like creatures versus hues, like, it doesn't go for that classic like, oh, you know, you can't really tell who's a robot and who's human. It's like there's a very clear kind of like almost grotesque look to a lot of the creature characters. Like, they all have a very clear look that's just like, okay, yeah, this is not like a regular human. That kind of like, I feel like worked in the series' favor. Like, all of the character design stuff, honestly, across the board is really strong. Like, kind of Hyaku is kind of really smartly done in terms of, you kind of don't see her properly in like the first chapter. It's very much that sort of like, don't show the monster until you really want to kind of thing, because it just builds up. It's like, oh, like, you know, she is this weird sort of grotesque creature just sort of made up of spare parts herself. And yeah, like, I think the visuals of this just did a lot to carry me on, because there's something really striking. I mean, again, part of the introduction is that, you know, Atsushi Kaneko is very much just like got into all of this through like punk and all of the culture from it, and that there's a real kind of punk vibe to a lot of this as well that I think, you know, is also catnip to me. And so I just kind of reveled in this sort of visually as much as anything else. And I don't know, I feel like it does a pretty solid job of the early parts of this story as well. Like, it kind of, it has a good flow to it. It's all pretty compelling. And yeah, like I'm very much on board, honestly, especially given it's three volumes, just to read the rest of it. Cause this just feels like a really good kind of like sci-fi version of this story.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's both faithful to, it's faithful to the core of Dororo in particular, with its own particular like little sort of angle and slant on things. Like, it even says in the intro sort of essay, it mentions that this was Kaneko's first sort of work, fully moving on to drawing on iPad, basically. Whereas before, when they were doing physical work, they were using like a brush pen, and it feels like they've managed to make the tool work for themselves, because the various artwork, and especially the way the art is constructed, is really smartly done. Like, there are spaces that are pure black but are still arrestingly drawn. Like, in particular, any kind of black surface or tattoo in particular is broken up, where you can see kind of like the brush strokes of a different color or light kind of impinging on the pure black, like you would see with like a sheen or a reflection. And so everything involved in that works really well, and it finds a really good way to use, perhaps in direct opposition to Kaina, it finds a really good way to use all the space it has and every last thing it shows. There's no screen tone here. It's all direct brush pen. And so it finds excellent ways to kind of convey everything about a scene or a panel within it with the work. Like, you know, you get so much more movement, and just like you get so much more of the characters in each panel, even though usually your time with them is quite fleeting, especially with the like, the creatures who are recipients of Hyaku's bits, really. And so the whole thing really has this intense sort of like just presence and solidity, and it knows what it's working with, and it knows that it both knows it needs to have things be cool, and it knows it is cool and can go with that. And even though, like, more, and you know, it's one of those things where like the everything is like detailed and carefully researched and thought about, there's so much thought on the page, which, although admittedly, then makes me get a bit weird and snotty when it's like, why those gun sights don't make any sense. Why would you, what's going on? Yeah, that's the sort of thing that makes you kind of trip up, is like, oh, well, you know, I'm blah, blah, blah. So, but yeah, it really kind of like develops everything there. And as you say, like, it's really good at depicting Hyaku, especially when it gets towards the like the backstory of like explaining like, why does she wear a giant like fur? And it's like, well, that's part of how she was trained, and also frankly it makes it a lot easier to draw. So, you know, it works really well. And, you know, the original story of Dororo, you know, of Hyakkimaru getting back his like 48 stolen bits, is a very good story itself, although a lot more Tezuka esque, where you've got a lot more Doro and a lot more gooning and sort of slapstick, but that's kind of normal for a Tezuka work, especially at that time. I mean, the original Dororo was three volumes, although it's three jumbo omnibus volumes, so it's like six volumes, really. And so, yeah, it looks cool as hell. You know, it kind of keeps the core, as mentioned, like I'm maybe a bit more down on it just because I'm a bit more snotty about it, but I love I always love this whole like Soviet futurism angle, but I think it overgooses it too much. Like, there's a spread at one point when it shows you like the city, and there's too many statues. Like, I know it's like a touchstone of like, oh wow, look at these like imposing statues they made. Oh, isn't it very Soviet? And it's like, yeah, but there's like six of them here. This is a bit much, even for the Soviets. Come on. And, you know, of course, all of them have like both a human and a robot in there because, you know, they've ended the war and they now are in a unsteady peace, as it were. Although it gets confusing at one point because they refer to it both as a civil war and like a different war where like they're being invaded, apparently. And it's like, wait, are those the same war? Are there two wars? Like,
yeah.
I don't expect you to give me a timeline, but I expect it to at least keep things a bit more sensible. And also the fact that, like, more than once, and this is probably the fact that I've already read Dororo years ago and have read it a few times since because I really enjoy it, the source material, but it loves to overexposit and really deflate what would be cool moments. Like even in the first attack on like the froggy fat dude eating oysters, they just find ways to like shoehorn exposition into the single most awkward moments in the entire confrontation. And it's like, you really didn't need to do that. Like, you're good enough at the art where it had already become obvious what's happening here. You didn't need to then like over egg the pudding and say, oh, but that's highly illegal what you've done. And it's like, you're talking to a giant frog mafia man. But yeah, I liked my time with it, but at the same time, it comes so close to being great, but doesn't quite get there. And it kind of makes it a bit of a pain in the arse. But it makes it aggravating to read as a result, because it's so close to fully realizing everything. But like, a lot of the speech is outright clunky as hell or really flat and, you know, very sort of like, as you know, I am your brother type, like exposition just laid out there. It's like, yeah, you didn't need to do that, because you already made clear through the artwork and what's happening, what the deal is. Like, you don't need to have anyone open their mouth apart from just say, ugh, you know, or blurg. So yeah, it's one of these things that makes it very annoying, where it feels like it doesn't trust you as the reader to get what it's trying to lay down, quite obviously, in the artwork.
It definitely has its moments on that. Like, I mean, I'm not sure whether I just kind of got into the cadence of how it was it's written, because, yeah, like, it's sort of, especially like the first sort of chapter or so, like, it definitely feels like you say, with that sort of first sort of mafia boss guy, it's just like, yeah, you're telling me what the imagery has already basically told me about this guy, and it's like, you know, there's really minimal new information to bring across there. Like, I didn't feel it quite so keenly from that point onwards, but like I say, I think that was maybe more just kind of getting used to like, okay, yeah, this is what this series is going to do at this point.
Yeah, I mean, a part of it is the fact that like, I'm, you know, already know Dororo, and I'm like, yeah, I want to see this adaptation of Dororo. And it's like, you don't need to catch people up, because it really feels like you're just not trusting the reader at all. But yeah, the backstory is also, the flashback is really well handled. Like, I don't remember there being that much in the original Dororo about, it was just like, yeah, demons, what do you expect?
Yeah.
Like, the baby got stripped clean for parts, literally. And you know, there is something to be said for using like substandard or recovered sort of just prosthetics. Because it's already clear from like, you know, the stratification and the visuals in this series, which is thankfully something it doesn't outright spell out and so lets you have fun with, is that there's like huge crowds of these like very like tourist like fatted pig people who are really happy with their life, and they're clearly like solid, like, I don't know, like Home Alone style middle class families who are just in furs smugly walking in crowds, and then everything else outside of that like blessed you know, middle class like comfort are like war veterans and discarded detritus of the war and of civilization, both human and creature, who are like scraping a living. And that's kind of where all the, frankly, just the animosity exists, where you've got the humans who think they're superior to the creatures, who think they're superior to the humans, and who are, is it, they're in a really disgusting like sort of like underworld battle of supremacy and violence to scrape out a living. And also it vaguely, I mean, that sort of like living entirely in the shadows element also vaguely reminded me of like Batman the animated series, quite honestly. Like, I know obviously there's a certain amount of like shared DNA with the whole like futurism 30s type angle, much like the Soviet futurism in the art here, but it was, you know, when this series learns to keep its gob shut is when it's like really engaging, frankly, and it's just like really cool. And also, frankly, the fact that like not everything goes to plan, like I'm pretty sure this volume ends with a gigantic explosion, which like, not going to end well for anyone really. And even like Hyaku is like trying to like, is a whirring instrument of murder, but doesn't quite get it done sometimes for one reason or another, or just gets outright outplayed. And it's like, yeah, that's really cool. You know, it's not like these targets are just pigs full of slaughter. You've got to go the extra distance to actually close the deal. Also, amusingly to me, the little sort of DNA detector thing you mentioned, that's not internal. Everyone can hear that, which seems like a really good way to rumble yourself of like, hey, what's that beeping? Why is there a murder gremlin here?
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, and I mean, the whole thing with kind of like Hyaku just sort of basically running like on sort of instinct rather than strategy, like it really helps with that sort of like early relationship between him and Doro as well, because Doro is straight away like, you know, the second sort of like target that Yaku has is just like, no, you need to get out of here right now. Like, I get that your target is right there and you just want to slice them up and get what you came for, but you are just going to get completely obliterated by everybody else in this scene, so you might want to be a little bit more kind of thoughtful about how you approach this. And it kind of, it does sort of lay the land of like, yeah, this is not just kind of like unstoppable murder machine, because it's like, it's as numerous characters ask, like, why are you so angry? Because like Yaku is very much entirely justifiably angry.
She is basically an engine of murder, you know, trained by, you know, an almost like Golden Kamuy-esque bear encounter in the flashback. And after that, it's like, okay, no, like, you don't quite understand how sticky and weird like the underworld can be that you're stepping into here. So that's kind of a nice little, you know, combination. And also Doro has the, like, obviously, like, the original series, Doro was the, like, you know, reader stand-in slash kid slapstick sort of component, but it still keeps enough of the slapstick around, like the fact that when he brushes his teeth, he's just brushing the two little peg teeth he's got top and bottom of his mouth. And when he's asleep, he's like in a little sewer room, and he's got a literal bed of rats who are trying to keep him warm, who are all drawn, frankly, really cute. And
yeah,
he like apologizes to the rats and says, oh, I really appreciate you trying to help me out here, but I am cold still. And it's like, okay, this is like, there's, you know, this isn't just outright all murder. Like, it knows what makes Doro tick and work is being an urchin, basically.
I think for the most part, like, it does a really good job with all of its characters. Like, you know, some of the overzealous exposition aside, like, it's pretty good at kind of setting up its villains and its heroes, like, pretty nicely. Like, you know, the sort of the creatures that you sort of encounter in this first volume are all just really good kind of over the top villains, but just absolutely fit that world and that place, and just be like, yeah, okay, like, you know, they are exactly the kind of like sort of cartoony sort of villain, but still believable on the edges of believability that this kind of series needs.
Yeah, like, and also, like, I mean, I feel like there's like some shared DNA somewhere with like 90s cyberpunk movies, with especially the like art, like the face paintings and the like various like tattoos and all the female characters you see, all of whom seem to be like, they, you know, the men tend to be more sort of carbon cutter, like, oh, this is another mafioso who looks like he has like a square of American cheese on their forehead as their haircut. Once I saw that, I couldn't unsee it. But then you've got all these really cool sort of just like really punk ripped out of Johnny Mnemonic female characters with crazy tattoos, and it's like, oh, that's cool. I mean hell, like the eyeball dude, the art critic eyeball dude arms dealer enemy has like a really cool attendant who is this like just silent 2B-esque female attendant cyborg who, yeah, just like the entire top of their head is just like a black abyss, and it's like, that's cool as hell. And also like the single most don't take no shit character in the entire thing so far, and it's like, oh, this is cool. So yeah, like when it, as I say, it's just one of these things where like the little nitpicks that drive me mad are just dragging what is actually a very, very good series down. It's just, I find them so aggravating that it really kind of like deflated me each time.
But
and also frankly, the fact it's three volumes and it, you know, it doesn't really waste any time, so it's kind of, it's a pleasant fast read regardless, because I think it's around 260 odd pages in this volume.
It's about 250 pager, and that definitely kind of works in its favor as well, because I feel like, you know, again, having watched the anime, like that was a 24 or 26 episode series, and so the idea of this being just like three volumes and you're going to get through the whole story is just like kind of a little bit wild to me, having not read the original work. But yeah, it definitely feels like it kind of it works, and it's really well paced here, and yeah, like it ticks a lot of boxes that, like I say, are just very much kind of catnip for me. And just again, almost to prove the point of what we were talking about with Kaina, of just like, even if you're not like absolute gold standard knocking it out of the park narratively, if the visuals pull you along, man, does that do a lot of the heavy lifting for you. And I feel like this is definitely a series that does that to some extent because the visuals are so arresting. And, you know, again, even its use of kind of lighting, you know, if you're down in a basement or a sewer or whatever, it is dark. If you are out in, you know, in the bright outdoors, it is bright and light. And like, you have a really good feeling of like place all the way through this series that kind of really helps it and kind of, you know, brings it to life.
Yeah, I definitely agree on that. That kind of reinforces what I mentioned earlier about just the sheer ability to cram layers of detail in every panel with the brushwork, basically digital brushwork. But yeah, it looks amazing. It's, you know, it's a very arresting, that's the word I'd use. Like even most panels are on their own arresting, which is like, okay, no, this is, there's a lot of craft in this, and it kind of elevates it. So yeah, it's cool. It's pretty damn cool. I don't know about you, but I'm probably in for the rest of it, honestly. I mean, I've already read Dororo, but it's nice to see this adaptation. And I kind of want to see what other weird freaks the author creates out of them. Like, we've already had, like, as I say, the tongue guy, the eyes guy. And it's like, okay, like, this can continue to be cool. I look forward to seeing what else you can do with it.
Yeah, no, 100%. And yeah, like, definitely on board for the rest of this. So yeah, like, hopefully the third volume isn't too far off. Like, I'm not quite sure what the cadence of the chapter. Oh, okay, well, there you go. That's definitely not too far off at all. I can live with that. So yeah, definitely will be reading the rest of it. And it's also like, I don't think any of like Atsushi Kaneko's other stuff has been released in English, which is kind of like depressing reading this, because this is also like, I kind of would like to spend more time with this author actually and see like more about what their deal is. But from a cursory look through, I don't think anything else has like had an English release, or if it has, it's not currently available, I don't think.
Yeah, I feel like this is almost like a like trial balloon for trying to get more of their works published, because, you know, it's got that easy in of, oh, it's an adaptation, you know, it's a Tezuka work, and you know, it's kind of the easy in. I feel like, given the like the more sort of continental standard of the like opening essay, I feel like it's almost a you know, I feel like it's almost like the continent and the French in particular waving at us and going, hey, we've already got some of this. In fact, it mentioned that there's like a series called Bambi which was partially translated on a particular digital service, but it kind of like, it got the first two volumes picked up by DMP, Digital Manga Publishing. So even if you get that, I'm like, it's likely going to be terrible quality because their digital files are always garbage, frankly.
It's
probably a bit of an iffy one, but yeah, they've got a decent like body of work from like, you know, the 90s that is just not available. So maybe this is the trial balloon.
Yeah, I definitely like to think so. And yeah, this is definitely one of those, like, oh yeah, they kind of like manga in France. So yeah, of course, they have far more availability of this kind of stuff that we do not.
Yep, for sure. But yeah, there's even funnier, in 2016, they had a bunch of like extra works and artwork release, and it's called Comic? And it's like, okay, you know, kind of laying claim to Arts Arena. But yeah, is there anything else to mention about this?
No, I don't think so. No, but this was definitely one of those I saw the cover and like, oh, this looks cool, and it was cool in exactly the kind of way the cover suggested it would be. So you can judge this book by its cover, I would say.
Although personally I absolutely hate the font treatment of the title, because it vanishes into nothing, and so you've got a big S and then the rest of it goes I find it to be form over function, frankly.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's why I like it.
Frankly, I also have to lay my cards on the table that, like, if something's by Fantagraphics, I'm already going to be a bit salty about the whole thing due to their crappy digital availability, and also sometimes, quite honestly, their price points. So, you know,
yes,
I will fully admit my biases there, but at the same time, fight me. The use of the title is terrible on the cover.
Yeah, I feel like this is the classic. This is the kind of debate that I have sometimes in my day job of like, when something is mostly available like for digital purchase, there is a tendency to be like, it doesn't matter if it's legible on the cover or not, which is perhaps not necessarily a good argument to have. But yes, it's not a particularly good legible cover, but I like it anyway because it looks cool. And so yeah, that's it's one of those, like, you are actually right about this, but, like, my weird predilections for this just looking cool is just overriding me to be like, no, I think this is good.
I think the phrase for this is, you're correct, but you're not right.
Yes, exactly. Like, so sometimes right, sometimes wrong, always certain. That's us.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. That's been Search and Destroy, Volume 1. Moving on to what we're talking about next time. So I've picked something that I've been keeping an eye on for a few weeks, a few episodes even, because I've been waiting for there to be enough material to talk about, honestly. Until now, it wasn't quite long enough. But my pick is a Manga Plus series that I've seen quietly talked about on the social, called Kurumizawa's Folly, which has a very striking art style, which I'm quite looking forward to getting into. And Andy, how about you?
So my pick for the next episode is Gaia Team at the Gigantis, which seems like a fascinating kind of, like, basically a kaiju series, but it sounds like it's, and certainly looks like it's in some really interesting stuff. So yeah, like, I have no idea what I'm in for here, but I don't know, I'm fascinated by this, so I want to check it out.
It sounds like the sort of thing you get gifted by a friend because they saw it on like a Steam sale or something. It's like, what the hell is this you found? So yeah, cool. So thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed the podcast, you can find all our previous episodes on screentone.club. Please consider telling a friend. Word of mouth is still the single best way for podcasts to grow and spread. Alongside that, if you fancy, you can also leave us a rating or review on your podcast feed catcher of choice, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. You can find us on Blue Sky at Screentone Club on there. You can also email us, if you so wish, at show@screentone.club. We've got our Patreon, as mentioned at the very top of the episode. You can find that at patreon.com/screentoneclub, one word obviously. Personal plugs, as mentioned, I'm Elliot. You can find me on Blue Sky at Elliot Page, mostly once again posting pictures of cats, including in particular the cat that was like kicking me in the groin at the start of this episode. And Andy, how about you?
You can find me on Blue Sky at Hannah's.
Grand. So from both of us, thank you very much and good night.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. My name is Elliot Page, currently with Kat, who is trying to headbutt my genitals, which, okay, that's staying in the edit, get off, stop biting me. Anyway, that's the bonus topic. What? She's doing a stink face at me. All right, fine. Okay, I'm just going to rearrange this. That's going to be the bonus at the end of the episode now. Sorry, Andy. No, highly unprofessional.